Hello, hello, and welcome to the 17th Metroplexity Podcast, the New Year's Day 2011 edition. Have a bunch of questions, so I think I will just dive into those. We've got another couple of days, probably, with the end of the Abominable Snowman contest with the cleanup, and then maybe a little bit of other follow-up sneaking in. We'll see how that goes. I hope that everybody enjoyed the holiday content. I wasn't able to get in and do as much new stuff as I might have wanted to, but it sounds like people enjoyed themselves anyway, so it's good. Alright, well, on to the questions. We've got a nice block from Facetious. Eclipse Free is superseded by Just Say No. They're talking about the conducts for reset runs, which is in turn superseded by Closed System. Are there any more contexts that are subsets, supersets of other conducts? Yes. There's at least one more that I'm thinking of off the top of my head. And yeah. There are definitely some others. And there are some that are mutually exclusive in other ways. So, there's sort of a, if you think of it as being a number of slots, there's actually a fairly limited number of conducts that you could get on a single run. I want to say like 6 or 7. But I'd have to double check that. Like, obviously you can't get, multiple bests or, multiple contacts that you finished with, that sort of thing. How difficult is the most difficult contest you've implemented? You didn't have to say what it was. Well, let's see. Like, there were some that definitely, like, took forever. I mean, the Survivor's Quest is probably the most difficult just in terms of the amount of work that I put into it. And the number of, like, cases that I had to handle. I was looking over notes from someone recently talking, trying to work out the wiki page for David's branch of the Survivor's Quest, and coding that is as much of a beast as writing that out. Just getting all of the pieces to mesh up. Probably the content that, when it rolled, had the most problems was hacking, and perhaps appropriately for hacking. A lot of the, basically everything in hacking is more or less hard-coded, rather than going through like a scripting language in the middle. Like encounters have sort of scripting language that handles most of it, and techniques. I can plug other stuff in there, actual like PHP code, but for the most part I just use a markup type thing. But hacking works very much the opposite way. It's all really kind of heavy-handed, and that's actually kind of cuts both ways. One of the reasons that there's so much stuff hidden in so many interesting corners in the hacking content just because I was going through and doing all of it manually anyway. So it didn't really cost me any work, so to speak, to drop in, extra little hints here or there, special bonuses that happen, once in a blue moon or with a really specific set of circumstances. Do you think you'd implement sex changes, and will there be a conduct for getting 30 of them in a run? Kingdom of Loathing jokes aside, what I'm really wondering about is changing gender. I do intend to include that when I put in cybernetics. As far as the part of the timeline that Metroplexity is in, it's a relatively simple operation. And with your special gifts, we'll say. Not something that would take very long for you to recover from. So, yeah. that I would expect that to show up with the cybernetics content, which is going in, maybe visible partially before Old Town in a limited way, but the main block of it will go in with Old Town, the Old Town quest, which is the next chunk in the main quest line. So I'd actually expect to see that fairly soon. Why don't the donation skills rotate with the rest of the unearthly stuff? Mostly because they run off a totally different code base than the rest of the unearthly stuff. The rest of the unearthly stuff gets funneled through a script when you talk to Zach to return the items to your inventory. Skills could be locked down the same way, and they're flagged specifically as donation skills as opposed to otherwise getting permanent skills that are in the distant future. Eventually there will be run types where, you know, you may not have donation skills or may only have donation skills, that sorts of things. That's in their preparation for that. But I like the summoning skills being in as they stand. I mean, I put some thought into it when I was coding up the rotation. And I think that they're more interesting the more of them you have available. In that there's a lot more. I mean, like, you know, if you have just the urban lore or just Emerald Meditation, it's basically, you know, whenever you have spare energy of etheric, you can just channel it into that, which isn't a bad thing and is a choice in and of itself, but I think that becomes a lot more interesting when you have multiples available. There may come a time when I have to start rotating them, just because, you know, I put in something that was broken, you know, that sort of thing. But we'll see how that turns out. When will Season 2 end? When I put out the next unearthly item, should be in January. The item that is taking shape is pretty immense, though. So I'm not going to make any even remote promises on that. So it'll just be whenever that item comes in. I'll try to give a little bit of forewarning. I don't even have enough of the design done to get an art request to Puyo yet, so I wouldn't expect that to be a really immediate thing. It seems like the best survivor's quest to do in a speedrun are Hal and Dr. Emerson. Was this expected? Is this something you see as good, bad, or irrelevant? It was expected and kind of designed that way, in the sense that I figured, I mean, there's always going to be one that's faster than the others. Like, I mean, I can try to, you know, balance them so that, you know, depending on what you've done earlier in the run, what chances have come up, you know, maybe one of them is a little faster than the others. And that's awesome when it works. But going in, I tend to assume that I'll fail at doing that. It just seems like a solid assumption. It's not something that I think even the best game designers can do reliably. So going in, assuming that that wasn't going to happen, I wanted those two to be the faster ones, because they're the ones that you end up with if you just totally, you know, botch the university quest. And I didn't want, for example, David's quest to be the fastest, because that would put a lot of pressure towards a specific path through the university quest, or just result in a lot of people getting really cranky because they were, you know, trying to take the generally considered slightly quicker path of, you know, rescuing him and him dying, and they can't have a, you know, fast run, and they're angry and blah, 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 blah. But I wanted the ones that are always there to be the fastest, I guess. Which may be the wrong design decision. It might have been more interesting to make the ones that are the fastest hinge on success in the university quest. And put a lot of pressure there. Could really go either way. But that's where I was going with that. So I went in and sort of got things to within, like, the general margin of error as far as I can. And then sort of put Hal's Nocturamus on the low end of that margin of error. David's and Lowe's on the high end. And then compensated those two quests by adding some more content to them, like some of the skills you can get from David's quest, and of course the neat crafting stuff you can get through Lowe's. So I kind of tried to not really balance in a, you know, game mechanic sense. I mean, try to get them within shooting distance of each other, which they're probably not, but tried to sort of interest-wise balance them. Like, people are going to do Hal and Dr. Amundsen's quests because they're faster. Or at least, like, if you fail, you know, you end up can do those. But the other ones, you sort of, you're compensated for it in other ways. Do you have any stories about mechanics you considered implementing but then decided against? Well, the big one with that that jumps to mind, probably, I think, it's because somebody asked something that resulted in me telling the story, but I considered when we were originally doing design, having body be much more multifaceted and much more complex, so that it would track the amounts of, like, types of drugs and the interactions between types of drugs. So, you know, if you took a lot of stimulants, that would start to affect you negatively, which is where the idea that eventually shows up in Uncut Nova as the jitters. Like, you know, taking a little bit of a stimulant might, you know, would give you energy and, like, pep in your step. And then as you took more and more in one day, you'd have, you know, you'd stop getting pep in your step, and then you'd start getting something like the jitters, and eventually, you know, you would just cap out, and just be tearing up your body for no good reason. And then, with what you'd already, you know, had in your system, you know, adding other things on top of that could would, you know, mix and match in interesting ways. And I think that's really cool. What I ended up doing more with that is really offloading that concept into chemistry, both so that chemistry would be more interesting and so that I didn't have to do that. The problem that you have with any sort of design that goes along those veins is that adding a new thing becomes exponentially more complicated every time you've already added something. And yeah, that just gets to be a bit much, especially when you're talking about drugs that are a pretty, you know, important subset of items in Metroplexity. So yeah, that's really the one that jumps to mind. Yeah, there's a lot of other ones that I've considered that are just sort of backburnered for, you know, the right moment to come up. It's a really neat donation item that I want to do sometime, for example. Actually, the first donation item that I ever came up with before we even started doing, before we had Puyo doing art, before we were in beta, when we were still in alpha. I was thinking about what we did actually end up doing for donation items. So that was basically the plan. Eventually, I wasn't planning on doing it while we were still in beta. We just, you know, I was unemployed for a while, and we need to keep the server running. But the first item design for that I did actually eventually came out as the Midgard player, which I think is kind of interesting. The second one that I came up with hasn't shown up yet, but I'm sure that it will eventually. It's pretty neat. I think people will really appreciate it. Let's see. And then I sort of got sidetracked into doing things that were actually relevant at the time and just left those notes. Any truth to the rumors of upcoming left shoe and right shoe equipment slots? Seriously, in real life, I wear shoes way more often than I wear hats or offhand items. Metroplexity is all about realism, right? I actually thought, I'm not going to say long and hard, but thought some about including a, you know, shoe, boot, footwear type slot. And eventually came to the conclusion that I just really don't care about footwear. there's not a lot really going on there, I guess. The only thing that makes me a tiny bit sad that we don't have footwear is that I would want to have boots that you could fish up and then, like, match them into pairs and wear them. Like, that is my only regret, not having a footwear slot. Anything else will either do fine as a gadget or, you know, pants or a buff or something. And I think that there's a lot more room for interesting stuff, a lot with hats, gas masks, and so forth. Sorry to actually, like, answer a humorous question, but it's actually something that I put some thought into, so. Alright, just a couple questions from Al. Thanks again for all the cool Christmas content. Okay, not a question, but you're welcome. I actually, it's kind of funny, I talked a little bit at the front about how I didn't get in as much new content as I wanted to. And half of that was because things have just been hectic and I've been kind of burned out. But the other half was I kind of like went over things and was like, what do I want to add? Like, what could I really put in here that would be interesting and new? And like the meat of the Christmas content, the, you know, Abominable Snowman contest, really, I felt was more or less perfect, already, so I was kind of like, oh, I guess I don't have that much to do, so I focused on the Viral Carols, and, the end boss, as it were. Can we fight a giant etheric turkey next Thanksgiving? No giant etheric turkeys. The temptation is always there, but I think we'll stay away from turkeys. The butterfly float snowman was an awesome final touch on a fun Christmas week. Did we miss most of the content, e.g., if the scariness has gotten up higher? There was some content that was missed out on. The towering snowman was re-encounterable, and he had a drop replacing the gigantic snowflake, which went over to the butterfly. So that item just, I guess, didn't get released. Nothing really important, just there was a little bit of content in there that didn't get touched on. The Christmas and Halloween content is always some of my favorite in the game. Unfortunately, it also always corresponds to the time when I'm busiest in real life, too. Not to be selfish, but what are the chances of doing a cool event not centered around a holiday? Okay, that does sound kind of selfish. Never mind. Actually, I would like to do something cool in the early part of this year. We'll see if I manage to pull it off. The deadlines kind of help and hinder me getting stuff done. Help in that I always actually get something done, but hinder in that sometimes I bite off more than I can chew. And we'll see. We'll see if I can pull that off without a deadline. Were you planning to make underwater zones from the start? Do you have to go through and add the underwater attack tests afterwards? Are there any other new regions that will involve similar changes to most techniques? I was planning on having the underwater ones from the start, and more or less how they'd work. But I actually went through and added the techniques, at the time. There's a couple of funny bugs I introduced with that. Because certain enemies are underwater and they're attacking you from underwater, basically. Like the lake serpents, use the underwater versions of the techniques, and I totally broke some of them for a while. But, so it would have been a little bit better if I had done that from the start. I did have that planned, and some similar stuff will show up later as well. I thought that was pretty neat. As far as other regions that involve similar changes to most techniques, there are a couple of times I've considered it for some really weird content that usually isn't worth it. I would say you might see something like that way towards the end of the main story arc. Other than that, I would expect it to be more one-off, two-off type stuff. Why are there so many gaps in the techniques by ID table than the other ones? Obviously, some of them can be counted for by opponent's techniques, but are we missing a whole bunch, or is something else going on? Yes, and also kind of yes. The way that those IDs are used, it's not just the main form of the technique, like the one that you actually put into your deck, that has a number. It's also all of the sort of subsidiary forms. So if you have technique, for example, that, you know, gives you, you know, like we'll say Evil Eye, like it gives you, you know, the etheric attack, and then an improved version with Blood of the Ancients. You'll actually have three versions, one of them without Eclipse, one of them with Eclipse, and one of them with Eclipse and Blood of the Ancients. And some of the techniques have a lot of those. Like, I'm not sure if any of them have over a dozen, but it wouldn't surprise me if I went through and counted a couple of them to find out what they did. So it's partially that, and so there are a lot of subsidiary forms of those that haven't been discovered. There are a fair number of techniques that haven't been discovered, and then there are the enemy versions of them and their subsidiary forms. And sometimes that doesn't end up being super useful. There are a lot of enemy techniques that you really only see in one form, like a lot of enemy, like, closer techniques, like the enemy equivalent of, like, Short Burst. They're pretty good at only using at the end of chains, that sort of thing. So you might not even realize it. Other ones, you'll very much see the multiple forms of them. They work just the same way that the player ones do, which is convenient, because PvP uses the same sort of code that fighting actual enemies does. So if they weren't all stored the same way, things would be substantially more complicated. But yeah, so you're missing out on the opponent's techniques, which obviously you just don't use, along with a lot of the subsidiary forms of the techniques and a number of actual base techniques. I'm going. That was me pausing for a moment, going through in my head, trying to think if there are any of them that have more than a dozen. I don't think so. I think it caps out at about 10 or so, but and there aren't many of those, so it's not like, you know, Punch has 10 alternate forms that you haven't seen or whatnot. But there are a couple that are actually even one that you haven't discovered yet. That's just had its surface scratched. Have just a ton of underlying forms. Question from Excuse, can we still get Skrukal eggs? I don't think I've seen this encounter since the survivors went in. You should still be able to. Unless I broke something pretty badly. No, looks fine. I'm going with it are still available. We got some from Arcane, pretty new player. Hello, Connect. I have some questions. I hope you don't mind answering. Yeah. Pretty open with the questions. Sometimes you get pretty evasive answers, though. Do you prefer being called Kinnack or Mr. Winkler? Out of the two, probably Kinnack. Landon's also fine. I don't have the weird, like, quippy hang-up of Mr. Winkler being my dad or anything like that. It's just, I think I've been referred to as Herr Winkler more times than I've been referred to as Mr. Winkler, though. And that was pretty much just in high school German class, so that probably tells you how likely I am to know who you're talking about when you say Mr. Winkler. Will our heroes ever be able to craft a catapult? Craft is an alternate means to get into the slags. I don't foresee a lot of catapulting in your future, I will admit. If it comes up, I would cheerfully include a catapult, though. This would have been this Thanksgiving. We ended up watching Pumpkin Chunkin' or Chuckin' or something like that on our friend's TV with the Mythbusters guys. We don't, normally have a TV, so it was just kind of weird to, sit around and watch this show with, commercials in it and stuff. But, that was fairly humorous. From what I've gathered in chat and the wiki, this year's Abominable Snowman contest started a bit later than last year's. Was this a deliberate choice of yours, or was it delayed despite your original intentions? I wanted to give people a chance to work out the Vital Carol stuff in advance. It started recording for the Carolers and Crusher boards as soon as that went in. And so I wanted to give people a shot at discovering that and seeing, if they discovered that, would people go out and infect a bunch of stuff and get a leg up on the contest before they knew it was there, that sort of thing. Didn't end up happening, but that was why I... To my mind, the Christmas festivities actually started a bit early, so that started a bit early, and then the snowman contest kicked in a bit late. That was the majority of it. It also it's really weird with daylight savings time or standard time, whichever one of them are actually in now, because to get content rolled out, I have to have it rolled out now by 7, which when I get off of work at 5 is actually kind of cutting things pretty close. I guess get off of work at 5 at the earliest. And so on days where I'm working, it's a little challenging to get stuff rolled out and then, you know, make sure that, you know, I had dinner already so that I can babysit it and make sure that nothing explodes, that sort of thing. So that's been a little weird, too. Last year, this time, I'm pretty sure I wasn't working. Almost positive. So that was just a lot easier, time management-wise. When we kick back to the other time, when I'm done it, when midnight GMT is 8 here in Eastern, it'll be a lot easier for me to get stuff rolled out after work. Just everything flows a lot more smoothly. Which is a separate issue there. How come the festive knit hat wasn't in season for the holidays? It seemed like a good time for it. The rotations are based on the order that things were originally released. If I actually released an unearthly item every month, they would sync back up, so you'd get the festive knit hat every December until, you know, they were finally bought out, that sort of thing. But as it stands, because I've skipped months here and there, like this December, for example, we get sort of, they get sort of out of sync, which I'm fine with. Two main methods of gaining Christmas trees are documented, the gang warfare method, the massacre of the guards method. Were there other methods of gaining Christmas tree that went under the radar? If you include the gaining warfare method, including, using your clout to get them distributed to the campus and Southside Park, whereby other people who are completely uninvolved in game warfare can pick them up, then no. Which is to say that it all ties into either game warfare or going through the guards. But using the game warfare, you could sort of give away stacks of them to random folks. How would you have felt if nobody figured out how to increase their caroling or crushing scores? Fine, really. It would have maybe given me some problems later. I would have mostly shrugged and gone on with my life. There's a fair amount of content that I put in that just never gets found, and I'm really pretty comfortable with that. I'm slightly less comfortable with it when we're talking about, one-time or limited-time content. And in those situations, if something doesn't get discovered, I usually try to reuse it. That sort of thing. That's about the extent of how far it affects me, though. What are typical spading blind spots? There's a couple of, this is probably in reference to a comment I made about, the other ways to get Christmas trees, and they were sort of tied into, controlling the docks through, gang warfare, which is very much a typical spading blind spot. So yeah, and that's something that people have sort of been trained to do. Most designers, pretty much since Ultima Online, have kept their PvE, being player versus evil, or player versus environment, being like a quote normal gameplay, on one side and PvP on the other, and have this big wall. And I think that's kind of bullshit, to be honest. It's something that, I mean, if you're going to have it integrated into the world, and if you're going to, you know, shove it off to be its own thing, where, like, only the people who are into PvP for its own sake are playing against each other, I'm not really sure. I'm convinced that it's worth having. Unless, this is sort of a separate thing, unless that is, like, the focus of your game. Like, if we're talking about, like, a Halo, where really PvP is the point. And some Halo fans may disagree with me, but I think that that would be a generally a fairly accepted notion, that most of the gameplay time in Halo is done in PvP. And that, you know, then you have to ask the other half of the question, you know, why are we bothering to have the campaign mode? And I think that, actually, in that case, there are a lot more valid answers. I mean, you know, being able to train the skills you need for PvP in a non-confrontational environment, I think, is a huge benefit, for example, that sort of thing. But when we're looking at the flip side, like World of Warcraft or EverQuest or what have you, and you've got, like, you know, these very distinct boxes, and the main box is PvE, it makes it feel like kind of a appendage, and then it does get the development time it needs, and it doesn't feel like it's part of the world, so it's not really very satisfying, and yeah, I just don't like that very much. But anyway, because I'm of that development philosophy, and people obviously play other games as well as Metroplexity, presumably, that's sort of a blind spot. Some of the other things that typically are blind spots have gotten sort of picked up by the community. Like if you use multiple items and they include, like, the same line of text in each of them, chances are there's something going on. The message about, you know, it reminds you of Primordial Seas, I think is the first one that they noticed for that. It's like, oh, you know, this gets triggered under these circumstances with these items, and it actually gives you, you know, more energy from sushi, etc., etc. And similarly with Sunless Caverns messages. And that, I'm not sure if that would have been, that's not really a blind spot so much as a technique that I guess I don't like people. Like, I guess that's just an insight into the way that I design things. Let's see. Other blind spots. One of the things that I found is that when I'm putting something into the game, if I want people to sort of hammer at it and figure out what it does, I put no effects on it, just none, like no visible effects. Because if you put something in and it's like, oh, you know, like a weapon that's kind of, you know, cruddy, but like, you know, grants bonuses, you know, whatever types of damage it's used for, people won't spade it out. At least won't typically identify it. Which sometimes is good, like when I'm trying to hide things, and make them, you know, more challenging, come back to the content later. Something that I have to sort of avoid if I'm working on something that I really want people to dig into and figure out. The last one that leaps to mind is that there's the old phrase, you know, to try the same thing multiple times and expect different results. The definition of madness. Paraphrasing there, I probably butchered the quote, but that mindset is also creates a really interesting blind spot, in that if you need to do something 10 times or, you know, to be completely jackass about it, like 12 to 15 times for an effect to trigger. Especially if it doesn't, you know, give you feedback during that, it can be basically impossible to find. And there's some things that I'm really comfortable with being basically impossible to find. Sort of like, I mean, Easter eggs almost. And there are a couple of those buried hither and thither. And other ones that I'm really kind of surprised that nobody's ever figured out. Well, that's the thing that I was thinking about there isn't even in that category, so you can ignore that. But so that sort of repetition, and I'm a little hesitant to put things in that way, because it encourages a sort of like almost monomaniacal gameplay. Although, and other times, like, they do totally get figured out. Like, the farmer in the Fey Cavern eventually giving you a spade if you help him out enough, giving you a present. That is very much within that blind spot. But because people either, you know, phrased it well enough that people were figured out that he was, you know, worming to you, or people just really wanted a giant stack of mushrooms, or somebody just, you know, thought it was fun to try and make friends with the mushroom people. That ended up being found. And there are other things scattered around like that. A lot of them actually way simpler, that just don't end up being a huge thing. Don't end up being found. Let's see. The after holiday snowman encounter was pretty neat. Was this encounter inevitable, or were there conditions that had to be met? No, that one was pretty much inevitable. I just really loved the idea of them collecting all of the component parts of all of these snowmen, and then it being animated by the hat into this terrible snow monstrosity. I was talking before about how there wasn't really anything in the contest that I could come up with to put in, but a giant conglomerate snow monstrosity was definitely one thing that was like, yes, I need one. Also, rather nice touch how the summer coin has a buff that is in opposition of the snow beast's debuff. Actually, I don't think that would work for you. I mean, it might just in the sense that your will would be higher to begin with, but the empowered effects, and I think it says this in the mouse over text, so I don't think I'm screwing over any spades or anything, but the way that those are coded, it's actually a floor before any other modifiers. So, if you have, you know, if your base perception is 9, it goes to 20. You know, your base will, I guess in this case, it goes to 25, and then it's modified from there with any, you know, items or buffs you have. So, and then the percentages actually kick in last. Although there were some other pretty sneaky ways to get around those. Will the Adventures of Metroplexity ever leave our heroes outside of the city? Towards the end of the main quest line, you'll probably get to visit one of Midgard's facilities outside of Metroplex proper. Not far, but outside of Metroplex proper. But aside from some sort of short jaunts, you won't be heading to Hong Kong or anything. Let's see. The old family ornament and its description had me going, _O_. Wow, how deep does the rabbit hole go? Typically the rabbit hole goes pretty deep. Some things I just put in there to screw with people. That's not really true. Some things I just put in there because I think they're neat. I usually don't go out of my way to screw with people. I honestly found that I don't really need to. They do more than a good enough job themselves. But my Yeah, but the, I guess not specifically on the family ornament, but just in general, the underpinnings of the setting, and specifically, like, what the PCs are and what Eclipse does, you know, what Midgard knows and doesn't know, and how they understand what they know, and how that varies between different projects and different departments, because they're not really very good at sharing information, and how, you know, what the various survivors know, and how they have processed and understood that, and how that interrelates with, for example, the Fae, in David's case, things like that. It's all very, it's all thought out way past the point that will ever probably be directly revealed, which might sound kind of mean, but is there to provide, sort of the underpinnings, of what's going on, so that I don't contradict myself, so I can safely say, you know, things about, like, why you don't really get, friendly or even, like, choice encounters with the hounds very often, the Twisted Hounds. The fact that you just, like, it goes straight into them, you know, trying to rip you to shreds. And that's, you know, why that happens, why that's not a coincidence, what the hounds are actually like, you know, how the hounds interact with other people who are using Eclipse or not using Eclipse, other, you know, etheric entities, you know, what, you know, the Third Eye thinks of the hounds, what, you know, the creepy girl that hangs out in the VIP room in the happy hour thinks of the hounds, you know, what the average, you know, drugged out student at Metroplex U thinks of them, what, you know, the man behind the man behind the man behind the man thinks of them. You know. I don't think that any of the rabbit holes actually go for the man behinds, by the way. Maybe within Midgard if you're looking at, like, an org chart, but it's actually relatively flat. I don't... I'm a big believer in, two men can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Like, conspiracies tend to be fairly small. Like, the actual... like, the people who are actually in the know of what's going on in Midgard are not a... well, there are small groups that are in the know within Midgard. It's not the whole organization is this huge corrupt thing. You just end up killing lots of their security forces, who, like, are just basically punch clock dudes, for the most part. Jackasses, so you don't feel bad about killing them. And, like, are kind of hired because they're jackasses. But you'll have that. Don't mind my giant... train of thought rambling there. But yeah, that's generally how deep things go. And actually, there is an interesting answer about the hounds buried in something that people are trying to spade right now. And I think that if they thought about it really, really hard, that might help them out. Or it might just confuse them more. I'm not sure which. Thanks for the awesome game. I love it to death. Yay. You're welcome. And as I was just saying, I try really hard to give good underpinnings for that depth. And just, yeah, so that we don't... so that I don't end up contradicting myself. I really hate that. There was actually not terribly long ago, like a couple months ago. Well, no, I guess this was actually over a year ago. I was running a campaign, just a pen and paper role-playing campaign, and I had just, like, in, like, flavor description for a gathering that the players were at. This is, like, the 10th session or something of the campaign. I contradicted pretty egregiously the characterization of one of the hosts of said gathering. Basically, they were being characterized as the reasonable, open, tolerant people within the nobility of this country. And I had... they were doing something that was very openly antagonistic, rather than being reasonable with their own creepy personality quirks. Because, you know, nobody doesn't have creepy personality quirks described. Unless they're a bad guy. And one of the players called me on it, which was fine, but totally just like, once I realized it, totally like derailed like my entire thought process on the setting, and just like unraveled and fizzled out. It was really kind of like spectacular. I worked really hard to try and, even more so after that, to try and get like a really solid underpinning. And so even things like, the codes that Midgard uses in the Slag's lab to refer to its patients, you know, have really specific meanings, and that relates into, you know, stuff that the frat guy was talking about during the Halloween content. And there's no real reason that there has to be any sort of connection there. It's really, like, who cares? But, you know, there is, and so, like, I kind of get things knit together so I don't run into stuff. We've got some questions from Magnifico, also known as Mag. Did you change the way infected site works midway through the event, destroyed the weirdness of crusading virus crushers having to first infect all the sites themselves, or was there some mechanism there all along that it took us a while to find? Option C. There was a mechanism there that took a while to activate, and did not, to my knowledge, get deactivated. But there's a toggle there, basically. Now that it looks like viruses will be endemic on the net, is there or will there be a way for us to find or make some antivirus software less rare than a security trial and less drastic than a data scrubber? Yeah, I don't know. That sounds like something that people might be working on. I don't know. Okay. Will we have more chances to see if we can make the hypothesized coin of the four seasons without having to combine unique items from several players into the now whose turn is it to use an item? I seem to recall in some previous podcast you saying that the rewards for season resets have changed from season to season. The rewards for season resets will change. Not every time, by any means, though. That's, like, the seasonal resets reward, I guess, would probably change when one of two things happens. Either whenever Yoda gets bored with them, or when the Old Town quest comes out, whichever comes first. I'm guessing when the Old Town quest comes out, because I think these are pretty neat, and I think that you'll agree that they're neat and get neater. Now I'm just guessing there, but that'd be my thought. Any other tidbits about seasonal resets we might not know? I don't think there's anything that leaps to mind. There's some pretty neat conducts that people haven't found yet, and some pretty neat conducts that people have been trying to go for, but thinking about a little too linearly, a little less story-y, if that makes any sense. Are agenda encounters affected by a chance of PvP encounters? Yes. Well, agenda encounters are PvP encounters, if that helps. If there's nobody to fight, and you can't add any more defenders to the area, you get your agenda encounter. Which, I mean, might be control and add a defender anyway, but whatever. So it's all sort of in the same encounter. So they're inseparable. Yeah, I think that answers the question. This game seems to adventure a lot of collaborative spading. Is this a deliberate metagame design goal or just a happy accident? I would say little column A, little column B. There was a complete jerk thing I was going to do, which I won't spoil because I'm sure that I'll find a way to do this some way without being a complete jerk. There's a complete jerk thing that I was going to do with the achromatic metallic powder. And, like, every time that it was used, giving, like, a piece of the puzzle. A different piece of the puzzle. Right? Based globally. And I'm pretty sure that... I'm pretty sure that heads would have rolled, and all of those heads would have been mine. I'm more or less ended up not having that. Although there's plenty of achromatic stuff still to find, so I'm not too worried about that not having happened. There are things that I put in like that to sort of encourage team spading. Because I think it's sort of... on one level, Metroplexity is a single-player game, and on another level, it obviously isn't. And I think it's important to have that play through the different player archetypes. And I think that... So Bartle would probably kill me for saying this. But I think that it actually does play... Like, I think single and multiplayer does play through all of the archetypes. In that, like, if you're talking about... it's most obvious, I think, with diamonds. By the way, it's for anyone who has no idea what I'm talking about right now, it's Bartle, Bartle. If you look up, he has a really interesting work on basically... goal types, personality types, playing MMOs. And it's very interesting and I'm not going to say like a seminal work in game theory or anything, but it gets referenced a lot, especially in Kingdom of Loathing, which if you're one of the newer players, that's... If you didn't come from Earthworld and don't know me personally, you probably play Kingdom of Loathing, if that helps out. Or maybe we're getting a lot more word of mouth now. I know that we are getting some of that, which is pretty exciting. I'm a fan of the word of mouth. There's really nothing more exciting as a designer, or like gratifying, I guess you could say, I guess there are donations, which are also pretty exciting. But we'll say right up there, neck and neck, is having people tell their friends that they should play your game. Or, you know, like random strangers. Just because it's so... Like, playing a game is one thing. Saying you like a game, you know, even putting your money where your mouth is, but there's something very separate there, like putting your face on the line, almost, if that makes any sense, face in the sort of Eastern sense, of... You know, like, putting your stamp of approval on something in a public way, even if it's just, you know, chatting with some friends, that I find, I find really touching and, you know, I get all mushy. That aside, so, if you don't know who Bartle is, you might want to pause this and look up Bartle real quick. I think that there are single multiplayer aspects to all of them, and I think that Diamond is the most obvious. Like, you've got, in a single-player sense, you're trying to beat yourself. You know, you're trying to beat your previous personal best. In a multiplayer aspect, you're trying to beat, you know, everybody's best. And, you know, leaderboards and stuff. And I think that we do a pretty good job hitting both of those. The leaderboard ones, I think, are helped a lot by the seasonal reset boards. There are some other neat things that I want to put in to help those guys out. And I think the other ones are, I mean, just spading, we've got very much what we're talking about there. Like, we've got single and multiplayer. I think the single player spading actually sort of means two very different things. One, just in that you want to, like, figure it out and get, you know, the acclaim for yourself, which I think is really more of a multiplayer type thing. But really, it could go either way. But also just the people who want to collect all of the information for themselves rather than relying on anybody else. And I think that's a really interesting play type. And it's not a type that I really get to see or interact with very much because, you know, they're sort of off in their own little instance of the game, basically, trying to puzzle stuff out. And I think that, wow, do they have a lot of stuff, a lot of time and effort and interest in puzzling out. But yeah, and then we also have, like, the multiplayer spading, either, you know, spading something yourself, you know, to get the accolades of the community, or working as a team to spade things, which I think is really neat. And then you've got, like, the progressively less, like, those two are, I think, I wouldn't get a lot of argument with that those exist. But traditionally, you know, clubs are very much PvP focused. But I think that there is an underrepresented, or, like, understood almost, type of player that is very much interested in almost blowing off steam to a large extent, where sometimes you just have to shoot some bitches, right? And some people do it, you know, in first-person shooters, and some people actually do definitely do it in Metroplexity, which I think is kind of interesting. As I divert to another story entirely, I knew a guy, in my gaming group in high school, who was a, pretty crazy dude, like, sort of bad family situation, ended up going into the Marines and got kicked out for some pretty, I guess was allowed to resign, I think is more the way it worked out, for some pretty dubious conduct. But it was having a conversation with him a number of years later, when I was back in my hometown, about how he was pretty sure that if he hadn't had the opportunity to work out some of his, you know, like, issues and violent impulses through the framework of the game that I was running, just, you know, second edition D&D, he might very easily have hurt someone in high school. And I don't know, like, hey, that makes me feel pretty cool, like, from a from, like, a GMing, you know, saving the world sort of perspective, and from, you know, a, ha, you think we're Satanists, but, you know, we're actually, like, helping people, not only like that, but also just, like, you know, the shy, geeky, you know, kid, who, you know, I'm totally not talking about myself, you know, working up, like, the confidence and the skill set of, you know, dealing with other people in a safe environment, because that would never happen. But also just, I think that points to something that's very important about gaming that I don't think gets shouted back at stupid people who think that games make people violent loudly enough. Because I think that that's actually a really important part of why violent games and violent movies aren't, and, you know, violent literature, violent, you know, stone tablets, which I'm sure were the, making all the parents aghast back in Samaria, that, yeah, there's, I think that, that there's an interplay there that isn't being acknowledged. Which sort of, I don't necessarily think that on balance they're good, but as long as that side of the argument gets ignored, basically makes the video games make people violent, or, you know, like I said, movies, music, or whatever, make people violent, complete bullshit. Like, it just, it completely undermines the argument that, well, yes, you know, desensitized violence. Okay, like, I could just, like, there's a logical progression there that could make people more violent. But, with short of having an actual study to actually, like, look at things from a scientific method, we can't even really have a conversation about it, unless you're considering both sides. Anyway, my rant there aside, and then you've got, you know, the more traditional clubs, which are, you know, player versus player, not like, it's usually associated with griefing, but I don't think that that's really, that's really it. It's just a more externalized sort of thing, like the diamonds. It's, more externalized sort of competition, just that it's less about you winning than it is about other people losing, which, I mean, can be seen as a lot more negative, obviously, but can really go either way, I think. So, and then you've got the hearts, which I think similarly there's a underappreciated single player sentiment there, where, and I'm not sure if I serve that base very well, but I think there's a not small group of players that are really really happy to, you know, deal with NPCs and make the NPCs happy to the extent that they can, living sort of that vicariously. And I think that, and every once in a while I'll get feedback resulting from something like that. And I think that's pretty awesome. Sort of plays into some of the things that people complain about with the Squatter's King's Son quest, but it's not quite on that same wavelength. But there are, like, you know, like, the reason that you can turn down Mikhail's reward for clearing out the docks is, I think it was Argith originally mentioned this, I might be wrong. Just requested being able to turn it down. I mean, originally it was just like, here's your 500 credits. You know, congratulations. But, and that's why it's kind of funny, like, people will periodically be like, well, there isn't a, you know, good reason to turn it down. It's like, no, there isn't. Other than being, you know, a nice person. And you don't get, like, a shiny item or anything. There's some effects from that in, you know, the storyline. Just in that, you know, he has money to replace his grills, so you've got some new food options there. But it's not supposed to be commensurable. But yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. I think that sort of activity is really neat. And, like, I think you see it a lot in, like, single-player RPGs, too. More so, I think, in the sort of dating simmy-type games that only Japan seems to have. They don't really, like, export, except through weird websites like J-pop and places like that. But it's actually... okay, so I think I answered that question and then several others. But I was talking with Puyo, who I apologize for reiterating this for folks who listen to a lot of the podcast, but Puyo's actually a Japanese citizen living in the States right now, and so she plays a lot of video games. But she, for the longest time, the DS and the older Game Boys were not region specific. You could play Japanese and American games on them, and it wouldn't be a problem unless the, sometimes you'd have like the cartridge would only be Japanese or English, that sort of thing. But it would never just like say, oh, this is a Japanese game, screw off. And with the next iteration of it, it is going to be region specific, which just pisses her off because she needs to. It's really a pain to get games from Japan, in Japanese. She doesn't want to get all of her games in Japanese. And there clearly are some games that she'd want to get in Japanese, like the dating sim games, like I was just talking about, because it just came from here. At least when we're talking about non-PC games. We're talking about, console games. So, she needs some Japanese games. I would prefer the majority of the games to be in English, because they're just way easier to get her hands on. But she's like, do I have to get two separate DSs? Like, is that what's going to happen? So, we might end up getting an English, American region 3DS, and she might end up getting a Japanese 3DS, so we can swap when we need to. And I can not play any of the Japanese games, because I cannot read. Well, I would say I cannot read a word of Japanese, but I can read literally, one word of Japanese, and that's fire. And I'm not even remembering the pronunciation, and it just looks like a little stick dude. It's like, a little stick dude on fire. That's all I got. Okay. Any chance we could get a way to view our stored items pre-retrieval? I don't think so. Unless you really, really care for some reason, a lot. There would have to be some really pressing reason for that. Because it'd be a giant pain in the ass. So if there's some really pressing reason for that, okay. Otherwise, no. How about a year-end wrap-up on unearthly items? We've got some time. Alright, Midgard players. Looks like it'd take a lot of record-keeping and trial and error to get reliable benefits from this. Would it be significantly easier to use if we understand it better, or is this a job for Grease Monkey? I think it would be significantly easier to use if we understood it better. Grease Monkey couldn't hurt. But you'd want... It won't help much unless you understand it anyway. In the sense that... You can't really... I'm sure that you know this, but you can't really, automate something until you can do it manually. I would endeavor to understand it better first. Do some of the undiscovered features of the things have in-run applications? So far, it looks like you can get you +4 to a stat, or maybe +2 power to combat style you're using if you don't feed it any expensive and or hard to get in-run code modules. That, I would say that it is not intended primarily for in-run use. I think that things aren't as hard as all that, but... Yeah, I don't think that things will be as hard as you're making them out to be once you fully understand the item. But it's not... It's intended to be usable in run, which is why it gives you, their, little recordings and stuff. But its functionality is, largely based off hacking, which is still largely post-run. We've got... Dr. Amundsen's Survivor's Quest, and that's it so far, really, for the in-run hacking. And I mean, there's, you know, a little bit of extra stuff here and there that you can hack or not. But it will be, kind of ironically, more useful in some runs when the old down quest comes in, but I'd be kind of surprised if it hadn't rotated out by then. Zalian Defense Tool. I'm tempted to say that we have this one figured out apart from the mechanics behind when it changes form and grants techniques, or are there more features lurking there that many of the unlabeled buttons and such as... No, it's mostly figured out, I think. There's some neat stuff going on behind the scenes, but I don't think that it's anything really you guys facing at all. HK Games Helmet. Having the test encounters take energy... they shouldn't? And that's not the first time people have complained about that. So I definitely have tested it, and it definitely doesn't seem to take energy. If you could maybe tell me when it seems to be doing that, I could fix it. But yeah, it's not supposed to be doing that. And it seems to work okay for me, so it's possible it's something that got fixed when I recoded something at some point, but it seems to be okay now. It looks like we're really close to being able to beat all the non-etheric tests, which presumably unlocks something neat. If we can figure out how to get all the high rings in the ring tests, any hints? Don't try so hard. The ring test is balanced a little differently from the others because of the smaller number of evasion techniques. But the text labels are labels. I'm not sure if you can get the highest one on the ring test, like the highest label on the ring test now. But that's not how it's balanced at all, so I would not worry about that. Emerald Grift Shopbook, so help me. So help me, this one also looks pretty much figured out. Am I drastically wrong or only somewhat wrong? No, that was intended to be pretty straightforward. So the fact that, I guess, the two single coin items don't really have questions, and the two coin items do have questions probably means I'm doing that about right. It wouldn't surprise me if there was something still hiding in there, but... Oh, yeah, there's a neat interaction or two, but nothing earth-shattering. I would not worry about that. Okay. Llama Man. Is there a reliable way to get shark teeth from the shark? Yes. There are several ways to get shark teeth from the shark, and a couple of things to avoid doing if you want to get shark teeth from the shark. So, like, the optimized shark hunting strategy is actually fairly complex. But yeah, I don't think that the ways that are in there are necessarily unreliable if you know the variables going in. I know a long time ago you mentioned a blind region quest related to the book. Did that ever go anywhere, or are you still waiting to scratch the minimum to mechanism to legitly get the book? I really don't expect anybody to crack the mechanism to legitly get the book. Well, that's not true. I'm sure somebody will figure it out eventually. But yeah. That's not what I was waiting for. It's just a combination of having time to put it in and there being enough copies of the book floating around for it to be worthwhile. So yeah. Can you give us a single arbitrary context-free hint that might help us find something cool? Let's see. Order matters. That's totally unhelpful, but I guess that's what you get for asking for a content preempt. Have you thought about adding new chip memories, abstract sketch memories? Abstract sketches, I think I did add some more of those. But the, it's possible I haven't, so don't, like, shoot me if it's all the same stuff. As far as chip memories, I'll probably go through and add some more of those when I add a new batch of, Nero recordings. For the most part, they're pretty self-contained, though. And, last couple from Tech Gunner. Since this apparently hasn't been on its, forecast schedule, Happy New Year! Yeah, Happy New Year! Welcome to 2011. It's the future. More the future than 2010. I guess, kinda. I think 2010 sounds more like the future. But, in 5 years, it'll be 20XD6. Any hint on the remaining undiscovered skills? Let's see. There's still quite a few buried in the Survivor's content. I think 4, 5 maybe? Quite a few. So I'd go through that some. There are, I think, probably the oldest undiscovered skill. I'd have to look at the chart to say, but is linked to one of the newer ones that's sort of in the Survivor's Quest content, in the sense that they're sort of mirrors of each other. So once you find one, you'll find the other. They're both pretty neat, though. Let's see. Anything else? Yeah, that's all I've got for now. That was also totally unhelpful. But I would check out the Survivor's Quest content some more. Specifically, if you're finding something, well, it's just sort of going back to the spading blind spots. If you're finding something that does something, but, like, is terrible, might be worth a second look. Okay. So, and now we're down to me. So, let's see. Looking forward, let's see. I'm starting work on what will hopefully be January's unearthly item. It's, unless I can come up with a way to drastically pare down the amount of content that I'm putting in, though, it'll take a really long time. It'll be like the coolest item ever, but it'll just take forever. It's one of those things that I've been meaning to do for a long time and want to do right, though. So hopefully that'll turn out and be in time for January. If not, you know, you can get it for your sweetheart for Valentine's Day. And I would like to get in a neat sort of world event, which is what I would call the generic name for holiday events, like, you know, Christmas, Halloween, Metroplex Day. So, something like that, but not tied to a specific holiday. Actually, exactly like Al was asking about, which is kind of funny. Actually, in a perfect world, I would get two of those in the first half of this year. We'll see if that actually happens. But yeah, I would like to... There are those two. And then a quest that I'd like to get in. Like a side quest, basically. Pretty short, but the little location revamp that I've mentioned, which I've had art for since, like, the dawn of time, but I haven't gotten around to doing. And cybernetics and Old Town. And honestly, like, best case scenario, that's probably my entire year. You know, when you throw in, you know, the next year's, well, this year's, I guess now, Halloween and Christmas content. And the, you know, Metroplex Day and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah. So, in theory, I mean, if everything goes perfectly according to plan, I'm not honestly sure if this fits even in my wildest dreams. The two world events, small side quest, the pre-Old Town Cybernetics stuff, just the cybernetic lab that Boris refers you to, doesn't do anything right now. And that would be the sort of the intro cybernetics stuff. And then, like, the full cyber clinic would be in Old Town. So, like, you can take the arm, you can install things like that. And then let's see. I think the people will be really excited about the little side quest image. Oh, yeah, and then the small area regen. And there's a lot of... One of the world events has a lot of stuff that I sort of alluded to in this podcast wrapped up into it. The other one will just be awesome and works as sort of the springboard for the side quest that I want to put in. In that, I can't really put in the side quest until that world event is done. So, we'll see how that goes. So, in a perfect world, by the end of the year, we'll have Cybernetics in, Old Town in, some more gang warfare stuff, including an area in Old Town. It's really neat. I really want to code that area, but it'll be a bit. And a system related to that side quest that I think people will be really excited about. So I guess I can't really say much more without, you know, just bagging up the place. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to the new year and getting a bunch of new stuff in. I'm not sure if the goals I have set for myself are even remotely reasonable. Or rather, I'm pretty sure that the goals I've set for myself are not remotely reasonable. So we'll see how that plays out. My priority for now is to get at least one of those world events done. To get the first world event done. The priority for the year is to get Old Town in. So it's possible that the other world event I was talking about and the side quest would be kind of the first thing to get pushed to 2012 if I need to. It's sort of floating. So I don't have to worry about that too much. So we shall see. As a side note, both of those world events are involved in releasing a bunch of new content, which is not directly associated with the world event. So it will be a little less like Halloween and Christmas in that, like, there will be a part that's self-contained, but it will also, you know, sort of blossom a bit. Sort of like how you've got the virus coming out of Christmas that sort of stuck around. And let's see, I would assume the boss for the sort of the final boss, so to speak, the Caterpillar Snowman at the Butterfly, will be out probably like January 7th, let's say, when the students get back and actually clean everything up. You can only really buy it once, though, so by the time that's rolled around, it'll probably be done and good to go. Okay, so I think that my aimless rambling about goals has probably just confused everyone, but I guess, okay, so, yeah, pulling out of the simmering stew of ideas, my immediate goal is to get the first Loaves of World events out. So I would expect to see that, I'd say, later this month, maybe February if I suck. And then I'd like to get the Old Town Quest in this year. I'm not sure if that's even realistic, but I will strive mightily to get that quest in. We'll see how that goes. Thanks for playing, and thanks for listening. Thanks very much for donating, and like I said before, suggesting Metroplexity to your friends, saying nice things about us. And I will look forward to the world event that will hopefully be coming out, and I'm glad that everybody had a good time with Christmas and New Year's. And I will get a discussion thread for this up on the forums in case I let anything exciting slip that you want to talk about. Thanks, and have a good one.